Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Hi, my name is Joshua Hatton, and this is Durham Manufacturing. The Durham Manufacturing Company was established in 1922. We manufacture industrial storage, safety, and material handling products. Our products are used in industrial, commercial, retail, and office environments to organize, secure, and transport a variety of production, maintenance, and repair parts. Our products are key components for 5S, MRO, and Lean programs, ultimately helping customers to save money. Time is money, and if you're not organized and cannot find your parts, you ultimately spend unnecessary resources. All products are manufactured to high quality standards, are heavy duty, and are designed to last for many, many years. Our product families include high-density lockable storage cabinets consisting of 16, 14, and 12-gauge steel. Heavy-duty carts and trucks, including specialty carts for special purposes, and trucks with capacities ranging up to 10,000 pounds. Small parts and space-saving storage include bins, drawer cabinets, rotating storage, and plastic hook-on bins used for organizing and merchandising fasteners, electrical parts, plumbing, and HVAC fitting, and more. Hook-on bins are used with our cabinets and carts or as stackable shelf bins. Our workstation product line consists of mobile and stationary heavy-duty workbenches, assembly benches, die and machine tables, and shop capacities ranging up to 14,000 pounds. And our safety product line includes FM-approved flammable storage cabinets, gas cylinder storage, PPE and spill response cabinets and carts. As you now know, Durham Manufacturing makes a multitude of products, but today I wanted to go over our facility maintenance cart. Basically, this is a 5S or lean cart that allows the maintenance or repair technician to visit their crib once in the morning, loaded up with everything they need that they can use throughout the day in the shop. So why don't we go over some of the features on this cart? Why don't we start with the drawers? All 6 drawers can be locked with 1 locking bar and 1 padlock. For additional storage, we also have a cabinet that's padlockable. It features 9 hook-on poly bins and a welded center shelf. On the end of the cart, there's a caddy for holding fluorescent bulbs. You can put 2 boxes in there, 1 for new bulbs and 1 for spent bulbs. On the back of the cart, there's a welded-on bracket that allows you to hook on any standard ladder up to 6 feet high. The top of the cart features a non-skid rubber mat and a backsplash as well, giving you a perfect work surface for any maintenance or repair item. This cart features an overall 1,200-pound capacity, and with the ergonomic handle welded to it, it makes it easy for you to push it around the shop. Well, we hope that this information has been beneficial to you. If you have any questions or further inquiries, feel free to visit us at durhammfg.com.
I'm Tim Strange from Strange Motion Rod and Custom. This is my hot rod shop. And it doesn't matter if you've got a hot rod shop, a normal automotive shop, a home garage, or even a huge manufacturing facility, organization is the key where time is money. And around here, we lean heavily on the Durham manufacturing product. So I'm going to take you around the shop a little bit today and show you just what Durham does to keep us organized. This cabinet here, you have the choice of either letting it sit on the top of a counter or you can mount it on the wall. This cabinet is great for your aerosols. It's got dividers to keep everything clean and organized, and it'll hold up to 88 normal size aerosol cans. Cool thing is, it's fully welded and powder coated inside and outside to also make it easy to clean and corrosion resistant for many, many years. And it's got sleeves on the doors for notepads and even your MSDS paperwork. And you can even lock it up and take the key. This heavy-duty cabinet is made out of 14-gauge steel, fully welded and powder-coated, has a 2,400-pound capacity. All the openings are angled so it's easier to get stuff in and out, and they're available in 3, 6, 9, and 12 openings, and the cool part is it's got casters that are lockable so it's mobile to your workspace. The new Durham heavy-duty bearing slide rack has bearings in the sliders, makes it able to hold up to 75 pounds. They're perfect for organizing any types of hardware, small items that you might need, and there are 11 different variations of drawers. And the cool thing is they're also removable, so you can take them right to your job site, wherever you're working. The stand is modular and can be used with any other Durham cabinet of the same dimensions. This cabinet is secure and lockable. It's made out of 14-gauge steel. It's powder-coated for corrosion resistance and ease of cleaning. It's perfect for 5S and lean applications. Between the hook-on bins on the doors and the bins inside, there's 208 places to keep everything clean, organized, and tidy. This cabinet here is perfect for different sizes of hydraulic and air hose. It comes with different size openings, and you can order it with a different configuration if needed. The adjustable base allows you to do that. It is powder coated for ease of cleaning and corrosion resistance for many, many years, and it's got a 40-hole bin right here, easily mountable for all your hardware and fittings to go along with any hose application you might come across. This heavy-duty cabinet is made out of 12-gauge steel, comes with a padlockable handle, and is fully textured powder-coated for ease of cleaning and years of corrosion resistance, and it's going to look good for many, many years. It's got a couple shelves in here, and it'll hold up to 1,900 pounds per shelf, and it's got a bunch of bins in here that are hook-on. You can move them around, and you can divide them to easily double your storage space. Durham's cabinet line is offered in 12, 14, or 16 gauge all welded steel and powder coated with over 400 different cabinets to choose from. Cabinets can include bins, pegboard, louvered panels, drawers, and shelves, creating endless options of organization. If a quality storage cabinet is what you need for your shop, you're sure to find it at Durham Manufacturing Company.
Welcome to 101 East. I'm Steve Chow. They're one of fashion's most enduring icons worn by people the world over. But what does it take to produce a pair of jeans? In this undercover investigation, we travel to the Chinese city of Xintang, the denim capital of the world, and find workers exposed to life-threatening diseases. This week, Lin Li and James Leong revealed the real cost behind the making of a pair of jeans.
Hidden behind factory doors across China, workers toil to produce one of the world's most popular fashion staples, denim jeans. But for some, there's a heavy price to pay. In a one-year investigation, 101 East travels to southern China, producer of nearly a third of the world's jeans. We meet workers exposed to dangerous conditions. We witness the devastating environmental damage caused by the industry. And in the most shocking discovery of all, we find factories using a deadly process to manufacture jeans: sandblasting. We discover that while some big brands are cleaning up their act, others continue to turn a blind eye. Working undercover, we spend time inside a factory where conditions are appalling. We also discover jeans bearing the names of two major American labels. This is what sandblasting looks like. Fine sand is channeled into an air gun and then sprayed at high pressure onto denim in order to make the fabric look fashionably worn. It's fast, cheap, and dangerous. Constant exposure to minute particles can lead to a deadly respiratory disease known as silicosis. In 2009, Turkey banned the process after hundreds of former workers were diagnosed with the disease. Dozens more have died. But it remains legal in China. Zhang Guanghua runs a mobile operation providing sandblasting to various factories. The supply chain is complicated, and most of the time, Zhang doesn't know which label he's doing work for. He and his team are paid around 6 cents for each pair of jeans they sandblast. It's dusty, dirty work. Tiny sand particles fill the air, and there's a sharp stench in the poorly ventilated factory. But Zhang believes he is adequately protected. Other workers we meet seem equally unfazed. Liu Guanghui has been sandblasting for more than a decade. His colleague Luo Bin for 8 years.
像你说的喷砂对身体有害，应该我感觉应该没什么害，那因为喷砂的话它是对身体有害的，我觉得是马六，相对来说喷砂跟手擦对身体没什么害的，就马六，马六它那个是那个高锰酸钾吧，化学物品来的嘛，喷砂的说实在就是物理反应一样，你把上面表皮打掉一层。
But industry leaders, activists, and medical practitioners disagree. And in 2010, Levi's and H&M launched a global campaign to eradicate sandblasting. Many other labels have also vowed to abandon the practice. Labor rights activist Liang Pui Kwan says some brands are not honoring their word.
The famous brands, they actually made a volunteer promise to stop sandblasting in their production. But in China, when they have their operation in China, they just don't care what is happening in the factories.
To find out what's really going on, we travel to Xintan, an industrial city in southern China known as the jeans capital of the world. Almost every other business here is linked to the trade, from dyeing plants to weaving workshops, huge facilities surrounded by high walls, and tiny backyard factories overflowing with garments. Our first stop is Conching, one of China's biggest denim manufacturers. On its website, Conching lists numerous international brands as its clients. It also openly advertises sandblasting services. Posing as a worker, our researcher goes to Conching's recruitment office to find out if there are any sandblasting jobs available.
有没有喷砂呀？
没喷砂了，现在不做喷砂了。哦，都不做喷砂，我之前都他们说让我到这里来。没有，喷砂上一年就没做。
At a mid-sized sewing factory in the city, we meet clothes sourcing expert Edward Knappheid. His client is a German discount chain, and Knappheid tells us that even cheaper European labels have strict codes of ethics for their suppliers. We ask him about sandblasting.
I will lose the confidence to my customers, or they losing it to us, if we trying to use it, you know, or when we use it. So there is no option for us even to think about it.
Our next stop is Zhongshan Yida, a major contract manufacturer servicing high-profile brands like Levi's and Gap. The plant is modern, efficient, and nothing like some of the small backyard operations we've seen. The CEO of Yida's parent company says the factory stopped sandblasting in 2010. But admits it wasn't easy.
Initially, it was very tough because, you know, using the new technologies, it cannot produce 100% of the look of sandblasting, which the customer needs.
Outside the factory, a worker who doesn't want to be identified confirms that Yida no longer has a sandblasting unit. But he says there are other problems.
有些车间工作量大，有时候会加班加到一天或者两天不下班，这个也有，但是就是一年可能就一两次，可能不是厂里的决定，应该有些就是他们主管啊或者经理啊，就这样子为了赶货嘛，就有些那些买假的员工嘛，他那个手势啊，那个手经常就是做那种动作。
The company's CEO denies employees are forced to work excessive hours.
They can opt out for sure, but most of them because they want to earn more money also. Because working overtime actually pays quite a lot more, so they are willing and would like to work more overtime. You know, but we have our we cannot work too much overtime above the local labor laws because we cannot exceed the local labor laws.
So far, our investigations show that although there are factories in China that offer sandblasting services, most international brands steer clear of the practice. But we've been alerted to possible violations at another factory. We head to the nearby port town of Ma Chong. From the outside, Tianqiang looks like any other industrial building. But inside, secret footage shot by a former employee whom we will call Sean tells a disturbing story. Photographs taken by Sean show chemicals haphazardly stored in open containers. Inside a crowded room, workers spray potassium permanganate onto rows of jeans to give them a faded look. The process can be safely carried out, but for these workers the risks are high. They wear very little protective gear, often coming into direct contact with the chemical. Overexposure can irritate eyes and skin and cause nausea, vomiting and respiratory problems. Throughout the factory, the pace is frantic. The place looks like it hasn't been cleaned in years. There's even a notice on the wall warning the workers that exposed electrical wires have turned their dormitories next door into a fire hazard. In a separate area, away from the main factory, is the sandblasting unit. This looks like one of many factories making cheap jeans for the domestic market. But it appears they're doing work for foreign brands, including American Eagle Outfitters. This photo, which Sean says was taken in the sandblasting unit, shows a Hollister label. Carl Borgschultz has worked in the textile industry for more than 25 years and advises on sustainable work practices. We ask him to look at Sean's footage.
These little face masks, this paper mask, that does not keep you safe dealing with this. If you want to really do this in a well-maintained industrial process, you really have to wear a real solid mask where you have a outside air supply, so that the air you breathe is definitely not the air which is in front of you with all the sand and the dust in it. Nothing's sufficient. The light isn't sufficient. The overall situation is not sufficient. There is nothing. This is a type of place you should tear down and build a proper new one. So there is nothing at all is okay. Dark, dirty place.
A researcher has got a job inside Tianqiang factory, working undercover for a few days. We've asked him to keep a lookout for labels and brands. The factory is big, noisy, with piles of denim everywhere. But he spots this easily. American Eagle Outfitters. He doesn't find any jeans with the Hollister label. But inside the chemical spraying unit, there's this. Abercrombie & Fitch, a major US clothing retailer that also owns Hollister. A separate building houses the workers' dormitories. They are dark and dingy. It is not clear if electrical wiring are still posing a fire risk. Inside the communal canteen, exhausted workers spend their lunchtime sleeping. Despite repeated attempts, our researcher isn't able to do any secret filming inside the sandblasting unit.
,它的保安看得比较紧,它的门也是锁得比较紧的。那一般人进去就比较难。他们为什么会看得这么严,据我估计可能是跟喷砂这道工序有点敏感有关系。 因为我相信可能工厂它多多少少也会知道一点，就是喷砂这道工序对人的身体的伤害是比较大，那可能他们也会知道有一些品牌已经开始慢慢的会要求不要用喷砂这道工序了。
This is what A&F says on one of its websites. Abercrombie & Fitch is proud of our commitment to international human and labor rights and to ensuring that our products are only made in safe and responsible facilities. A&F does not support the practice of sandblasting during the manufacturing process of our goods. American Eagle Outfitters is even more unequivocal. The company joined the initiative to eliminate sandblasting in 2011. It says, "Until we believe that proper controls can be put in place to ensure that sandblasting is done safely, we are no longer developing new denim styles with sandblasting." So why are these two companies working with a factory like Tianxiang?
Either they don't do the monitoring properly and work with business partners, suppliers, traders, which they don't monitor well enough, so that they don't know which factory these people are using, or they really squeeze out the last cent in the sourcing process, and then of course it's their responsibility as well, because it's easy to pay 10-20 cents more and go to a factory where you have good condition.
It's not only factory workers who are suffering from unsafe work practices. The environment is also paying a heavy toll. Outside Tianxiang, a pipe leads directly into the river. The stench is overpowering. A short distance away, farmers work the land. Long before factories moved into the area, Ma Chong was better known for its bananas. 81-year-old Mr. Mo was born here. He says the area has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. Over the years, villagers living near Tianxiang have lodged official complaints accusing the factory of damaging the environment. But they say things haven't improved.
We just need to lock down that venue because then we've got the date.
Christina Dean is the founder of Redress, an NGO advocating sustainable solutions for the garment industry.
Well, producing denim and producing jeans is highly polluting, and it also requires a huge amount of natural resources. Now, research has indicated that just producing one pair of jeans requires 3,625 litres of water, 3 kilos of chemicals, and 400 megajoules of energy, which is the equivalent of running a light bulb on 24 hours a day for 116 days.
Left unchecked, the results can be disastrous. This is a common sight around many factories in Ma Chong and Sintang. Chemical-laced water polluting the land. Mountains of discarded fabric left to rot in the sun. Observers believe the culprits are usually factories that don't work for big-name clients.
There is a global trend for brands to be more responsible and to be more aware of what they do, and that is in response to increased consumer awareness about the dirty production that goes on in the fashion industry.
So again, why are Abercrombie & Fitch and American Eagle Outfitters working with a factory like Tianxiang? Liang and her fellow activists have decided it's time to shame Tianxiang's customers. They're protesting outside an American Eagle Outfitters store in Hong Kong. The same day, they also release a report on China's denim industry. In it, they describe the conditions in Tianjiang factory and name American Eagle Outfitters and Hollister as its clients. It's time for us to act. First, we email American Eagle Outfitters and Hollister's parent company, Abercrombie & Fitch, asking them for their response to the NGO's report. We also tell our researcher to head back to Ma Chong. He arrives 2 days after the protest. At the gate leading to Tianxiang Factory's sandblasting department, he pretends he's looking for a friend. A day later, we receive a reply from ANF. The company confirms that Tianxiang is indeed their supplier. The email also says, "We do not allow our vendors to use sandblasting during the manufacturing process of our goods, and we audit compliance with this directive on an ongoing basis." Time for us to visit Tianxiang factory to ask a few direct questions. We arrive 1 week after the release of the NGO report. Another man shows up a few minutes later. We hand him the NGO report and explain that we are making a documentary on China's denim industry. We ask if he can answer a few questions. While we wait for him to finish his call, our researcher, who is keeping watch nearby, has an unexpected stroke of luck. He meets a group of sandblasters and manages to record their conversation.
AEO是叫什么？ 我知道了，是不是那个叫一个老鹰还是海鸥是吧？
美国鹰。哦，知道了。你不用拍了，啊啊！不要见拍，不要，马上就砸掉你的哈。啊。
Where we are, things are getting a little tense.
把它关掉。关了，我放一边了。你没有，我这里你也取出来了，啊？啊。是要掉的，我要。我不是为求记者，但是你在洗碗，你要给个那个嘛，你就是你要采访也好，什么也好。
We try again a little later. As more men show up, we decide it's time to leave. After our visit to Tianxiang, we get a response to our email to AEO. The brand's public relations firm informs us that all sandblasting equipment has been removed from the factory. We write back, asking when exactly this took place. They refuse to say. Tianxiang may have disbanded its sandblasting unit, but elsewhere the practice continues. Over dinner one night, we meet Mr. Liu, a sandblaster who tells us about the death of a colleague. We ask him why he's still sandblasting. Global denim sales are expected to hit $64 billion by 2020. But it's these workers who are paying the real price for one of fashion's most enduring items.
If you open an iPhone, this is what you'd see. All these parts were put together by a company called Foxconn. Many of the parts themselves are manufactured by Foxconn. Almost any piece of electronics has at least some components from the company, which is owned by this guy, billionaire Terry Guo. He found success by making massive deals with the world's biggest tech companies and being able to follow through.
He's always put client delivery number one, even at times if that means taking a loss or taking big risks on buying equipment or setting up facilities, because he's confident that once he lands that order, they're going to be stuck with him, and it's usually the case.
He's even expanded operations into the US by building a $14.5 billion factory in Wisconsin. This is how one man turned a small operation in a shed into the biggest electronics operation on the planet. Foxconn is one of the largest employers in the world, with over 1 million workers during peak iPhone season. And that's a commodity politicians like to offer during election time, jobs. So when it came time for President Donald Trump and various US states to decide where they wanted the promised factory, Guo had them playing against each other for the best offer.
Wisconsin took the bait. And offered a lot. They offered massive incentives to get Foxconn there. Really one of the largest incentive packages in US history.
Critics say the factory will most likely not create as many jobs as promised, and people are calling it a white elephant. But Guo doesn't care. Wisconsin is paying him $4.5 billion in taxpayers' money, or $1,800 per taxpayer.
We've got a Green Bay Packers jersey with your name on it.
At the end of the day, Terry Guo is a big winner, and it's yet to be seen whether Wisconsin will be a winner.
Other countries have sought similar deals, including Brazil, Indonesia, and even various Chinese provinces. And that's because Guo has a reputation for being able to pull off massive operations, offering companies a one-stop shop for electronics.
And there's no other company in the world that can do what Terry Guo does, even two decades later. Foxconn is still the master of assembly. And it's because Terry Guo is always looking to try and, you know, look ahead and try and keep customers happy.
Early on, Guo saw opportunity by streamlining processes via automation and cutting out the middlemen. In the 1970s, Taiwan had a booming export economy. But most electronics from that time were made in Japan, where the factories were, and then traded in Taiwan, who had the connections to the Western world. A 23-year-old Guo worked as a shipping clerk and got a first-hand view of the potential to make money.
He realized, well, you know, there's money in this. Maybe I should go out on my own and do some of this. Why be the person in the middle when I can be the one doing the actual original production?
He decided to go into business for himself. Using a $7,500 loan from his mother, he rented a shed in a gritty Taipei suburb called Tuchung, bought a couple of plastic molding machines, and started making channel-changing knobs for black and white televisions. After that, he had a series of big breaks, starting with making components for Atari and later Dell. At that time, Dell and other PC companies would buy parts from their suppliers and assemble them in their own factories. But Gua created a production line integrating most of these parts and processes, from the raw steel for PC casings and electrical connectors to the final assembly. Gua was also among the first wave of Taiwanese to set up factories in mainland China.
He saw the writing on the wall in the 70s that this was a place to do business, to build things, to manufacture things, not only at a low labor rate, but there was just going to be plentiful staff. All these years later, 40 years later, it's almost the most perfect government corporate partnerships in history.
Eventually, Gua landed a deal with Apple, and the rest is history. Over 50% of their estimated $165 billion in revenue now comes from Apple. But it wasn't always going smoothly. Foxconn hit international headlines in 2010 after a series of workers' suicides at their main factory in Shenzhen.
And to put it in context, the suicide rate in China is around 20 per 100,000. Terry Guo had about 1 million people working for him at the top of the annual cycle. So that would imply 200 suicides a year. But they had, 14. Well below average, but certainly higher than anyone expected. And because this was a company supplying to Apple, it became famous very, very quickly as the Apple supplier and a suicide problem.
After the 2010 scandals, he raised wages, set up healthcare clinics, and even set up hotlines to give advice to help workers. Foxconn weathered the crisis, but it was already facing a bigger long-term issue. For the past decade, revenue for electronic hardware manufacturing has decreased, and software is on the up. Almost all the world's biggest tech companies are now non-hardware. Gua, who is a manufacturer at heart, hasn't been able to diversify products.
Foxconn has been trying and trying and trying for years to get into things like cloud services, software, but they're just not very good at it. Terry Gua doesn't have that creative thinking. He doesn't look at a product and say, how can I add value and charge more for it? And that's the biggest challenge facing Foxconn into the future.
Okay, today's podcast, and we've been sort of following a trend here lately on manufacturing, or as the new term, really not new, but more relevant, in crowd term, making or makers. Today's podcast is titled Dunham Manufacturing Blueprint, which had a conversation yesterday with Pleasant Stephens. He brought it up to my attention, and I called the company this morning. Dunham Manufacturing, which is a United States-based company based out of Connecticut. They're three generations in. It's a private company. Three generations in. Working on a fourth generation, I believe. They make lockers and workbenches and basically non-sexy stuff, but they take in anywhere from $10 to $20 million a year. They're actually about close to $25 million a year, depending on the year. But they started, this guy's grandfather of Dunham Manufacturing, they started with, it started in the barn. The guy's grandfather started this company that does nearly $25 million a year. He started off in a barn. And I called the company today, but it's President's Day, so I got to call back tomorrow to find out what was the first product that they, that this guy's grandfather manufactured and has grown into nearly a $25 million a year business. They've got The headquarters is in Connecticut, small town Connecticut. They have a manufacturing facility also in Juarez, Mexico, where you can get affordable, sustainable labor. And then they've got a distributors network. So that's why we go with Blueprint, and we'll get into Blueprint in future podcasts on that. Now, the last audio that I just played, because I played a series of all manufacturing type videos. Terry Gao, as you heard in the video, the audio rather, of the video, this joker started in a shed with 10 elderly people assembling parts. Started in a shed with 10 assembly with 10 with senior citizens that was assembling parts. Going back to the Booker T. Washington Tuskegee thing, I think Tuskegee started out in a shed. A former slave, anyway, determination and perseverance. Anyway, when Pleasant Stephens comes back on, yeah, on a regular basis, because his health has really picked up. I speak to him, if not every day, about every other day. I spoke to him yesterday about twice. But anyway, so he brought up Dunham Manufacturing. But because we want to get people in the mindset of making something. Make it and sell it. Make it and sell it. Make it and sell it. And I like to get a lot more. Guess we're going to make, because a lot of the videos on China manufacturing or manufacturing in Southeast Asia is, in my opinion, kind of biased, negative towards them, which means I gotta pick up either Mandarin or Cantonese or both to get more pro-China or Southeast Asia manufacturing, as well as Africa. But in any event, we want to bring more information on making something, including something for the kids, arts and craft. Making an ashtray, make something and sell it. Because what's amazing is, if you look at some of these black churches, just as an example, the King James Version of the Bible, made in China or Taiwan. The robes, made in China or somewhere in Southeast Asia. And we're talking about a black church, where we have the talent pool within those churches to print, to keep everything in-house, print the Bibles in-house, the robes in-house, the pews in-house. Everything that's in the church can be made in-house. In my opinion, that's the solution to marching and protesting. Anyway, let's see, we have Robin here. Oh, and tomorrow our podcast will be on parents. Parents with adult dependent children. That's tomorrow's podcast. parents with adult dependent children. Because what we'll be doing is we'll be going through some strategies on how to create mutually beneficial relationships in those type of relationship dynamics. Where some people just label it as codependent, we just have to tweak it with a estate planning mindset and generational wealth mindset, and then, like say, come up with some solutions for. But that's tomorrow's podcast. Parents with adult dependent children. So there is a huge population of parents that are helping their adult children. And some of those children have families of their own. But there might be some type of financial problems there. So we're going to look at some of the root causes of those problems and then some come up with some solutions that you can incorporate now. So that's tomorrow. Parents of adult-dependent children. Let's go to the phone. Let's see. Robin's back. So, Robin, Robin, are you able to speak today or in the mood to speak if you're there? Okay, the light's on. What we'll do is I'm going to close Robin's mic. Robin, if you are in the mood to speak, just press 1, we'll get you in. All right, 314 area code, your mic is open.
L.A., what's going on today?
Oh, you know what, I didn't know it was President's Day until about 3 hours ago.
Yeah, the banks is closed, whether you got money in them or not.
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, I'm just looking at it like an extra day off. But I don't need a day off anyway, so.
Yeah, well, I have a day off every day. But there's some interesting reports you had there. And you know, the one thing that...
I think it kind of... one-sided, but the most of my audience, well, I probably have to make up my, because the Blue Jeans, because there's I think a lot of these videos on YouTube, at least the ones I'm running across, I think are kind of one-sided, on a negative end, so I guess I got to learn some basic Mandarin to learn how to balance this stuff up, but anyway. Yeah, so yeah, because there's enough podcasts and YouTube videos on reparations and all these other things. So I guess my little part of the universe is let's get people to start making things again.
Well, one of the reasons why come the country where the video that you played is so commanding is the fact that it's cheap labor. And the cheap labor is cheap because that it don't cost much to live in that country.
Well, not only that, Bianchi, life, different lifestyles, and part of that is cultural because their consumption, they don't consume as much as Americans or Westerners do. And then
well,
when it comes to the manufacturing, you know, they're doing mass production. So when you got mass production, that's going to drive down the cost of everything.
Well, you're right. But you also got to consider that you're talking about a pauper, P-A-U-P-E-R society, a large portion of the society, is sort of pheasants and pauper style. So that in every little grouping, they have the ability to provide sustainable substance for their survival. Whether growing food, which it went from a garden to a larger plot where they're able to produce more. And then once they do that, they start selling. So, you know, I don't know if you ever watched some of those documentaries of food, and they go into those countries, and they have little cooking booths everywhere. They call them chop shops in Africa. And that's all the people do is cook food, cook food, cook food, grow food, grow food. They got fishing industry that supply them. Well, the West Walmart couldn't compete with that. Walmart wouldn't last a minute in a society like that because
right.
people don't need them.
Exactly.
And,
so, you know what? I noticed that even in Germany, Pianchi, because I spent quite a bit of time over there, and I was looking for opportunities. I'm looking at, man, now this is Germany, which is a Western country in Central Europe. A lot of Germans are do-it-yourselfers. So a lot of things
Absolutely.
We hire people for around the house, they do themselves.
Mm-hmm. So those are cheap sources of food. All right, well, if you got a cheap source of food, which is one of several costs for sustaining a people, a family, that
right.
there is taken care of. Now, all you have to do if you want to start up a multiplicity manufacturing operation is supply the other things. Let's say textiles. You go out and buy a bunch of sewing machines. And you can train, and most of them already know how to sew because they sew their own clothes.
Right.
You buy a bunch of sewing machines. You hire these people. And see, here's the thing. They all don't come from one spot. They come from a long ways. That's why the company has to make arrangements for them to reside. They have apartments for them.
They do.
They have residence. They done that here in the United States. I remember in the St. Louis area when all the commerce was down on the riverfront and downtown about to 12th Street, then everything west of there was wood. And what companies would do, they'd go out, like in the Kirkwood or, you know, parts of Hillsdale and that, and they would build these little small homes. And that would be providing residence for their workers.
Okay.
And they'd come up with some sort of transportation system which eventually turned into bus lines that would pick them up. You had a black company, the Safe Bus Company over in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They done the same thing. They started a bus line that would take workers from the industrial area out to what's now we call the suburbs, to their homes that the companies built because there was no other source for homes. And also the wages were so cheap they couldn't afford to buy a home anyway. So the company built the homes. And that's a good thing if you got, that would be a business expense that could be wrote off against your taxes, your gross taxes. So that's the way they did that over there in China. The people work for cheap. They don't need all
right.
that much money. They got a home.
That's true.
They got food. They probably they got some form of clothes.
Right.
Now,
right.
as time go by, that's going to change.
Right.
Because when people are working like that, they don't want their kids to follow in their footprints. So what do? They save up money so that they can send their children to higher education where they don't have to work like that. So that's why come that type of manufacturing, that's why come that edge that country has is going to change. The people are going to walk away from it. The same way blacks walked away from the South and went north, right?
Right, with the Great Migration 1 and 2, they walked away from quite a bit.
Absolutely. That's a human trait. Humans want something easy. You see it in Africa. The people come from what they call the bush areas, and they come to the cities. And they do whatever it is they need. They clean up, sweep the floor, wash the windows, take out the trash. They make money. They send that money back home, some of it, to help make a way for the kids or the family so that they don't have to live that hard agrarian life. But also that causes problems too. Because if you walk away from the cheapness, the thing that comes in and replace the cheapness is expensive things. So you got to make more money. You can't make more money by sweeping floors and washing windows. You got to have education and training and skills of demand that's going to pay high wages and salary. That's the cycle that you go through.
That's true. Yeah, because, you know, like the place like the Philippines, they have a higher well, I don't know what the percentage is, I have to look it up, but they have a lot of people that live that are from the Philippines that work, what do you call them, overseas workers.
Oh, yeah, they go all over the place.
Right, and then they send money back. But, of course, like you just said, the catch-22 of that is, although you're making higher wages, the cost of living, depending on your arrangement, you know, arrangements, are higher.
That's the way China does with this.
Where you're living at a place where they, you know, you got accommodations paid for.
Yeah, that's the way China does with its construction company, its government-owned construction company. Mm-hmm. When they move to a site, they bring in their hostels, their hotels. If it's on a waterway, they bring in one of these large boats that's got compartment after compartment after compartment for the workers to live.
Right.
On the construction site itself, they have their own canteens. That is, they bring in the food. They have workers in there cooking the food for the people to eat. They, when they get paid, the money is deposited in an account back in China. They don't receive no money where they can spend it in that community. They don't go out into that community and buy food. It's all self-contained. They don't have to go out into the community and look for accommodations because they provide the accommodations. They bring in modular units, put them side by side on top of each other, and that's where the workers live.
Right.
And that's the way they do it. And that's why come they've been able to outdo the United States at the time being. But as time goes by, that's going to change. Because they don't like the conditions in which they live. And
everything has
any responsible parent, any responsible parent don't want their child to come up in hard times. You hear how blacks used to say, I don't want my child picking cotton.
Well, now, that's what tomorrow we got our podcast going to be on, like I talked about earlier. Parents with adult-dependent children. Because what's happening in a lot of your Western countries now, well, I'll just stick to the United States for this conversation, is you've got parents who've got adult kids who have their own families, but they're broke. Well, not, I mean,
you know, in a way, that's the way that should be designed. Is that
I agree.
You have a central support, just like the central support on a bicycle wheel, the axle, and the spokes are the family member that goes out into the rim, which is the outside world. Well, if something happened out there in the outside world, you just follow that spoke back to the central focus, the axle, the support system, until you recuperate and recover, come up with another plan, then you head out again.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons why we're bringing it up is because I have a friend of mine where his son is in his 30s, and his son has got three baby mamas and four kids, something like that. So, you know, as parents do, you know, and he's got, you know, long story short, his son is in the process of getting evicted. So he's looking at purchasing a house for his son who's married, but the wife's not working and the son's not working. Now he's advised them both to get 9 to 5. But anyway, we're going to get all that tomorrow with solutions, possible solutions. And I believe
that scenario must have been 20 years ago. I can't see nobody not having a job today.
Well, this is current. So we're going to do a whole podcast on that tomorrow on solutions. including the legal part, because he's helped them get automobiles before, but the automobiles got snatched because he didn't keep up the car payment. So we're going to go through strategies on how to
make. Okay, then, Ellie, I'll check you tomorrow.
Okay. All right, then. Thank you, Bianchi. Robin, are you available? Your light's on. Robin, press 1 if you are available. Okay, Robin. All right, well, tomorrow, once again, we're going to do a here we go. Oh, your biggest fan just left. Good morning, Robin.
Hello, everyone. Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. How is life your way?
Everything is great.
Good.
Yeah, everything is great. We are, huh?
How's the weather out there?
The weather, it's been about 55 degrees during the daytime. A little bit rainy, but it's been nice.
Okay. All right. Tomorrow, as I told you over the week, we weren't going to do it today, but we're going to do it tomorrow. We're going to be talking about parents with dependent children, adult dependent children.
Yeah.
That's tomorrow.
Yes.
So any thoughts on that before we get into it tomorrow? Because we only got a few minutes left on this podcast.
Just that, it's pretty common these days. You know,
right.
our children, you know, it used to be, we were chomping at the bits to be gone at 18, but now it's common for kids to be still home in their 20s and even raising their children still in the home. So, and with today's economy and just stuff like that, it's just common that more of us more people have adult children. Adult children that are still dependent upon them. Yeah.
Well, a big part of that is inflation. Let's take a person. Well, my mother, she's, you know, been gone less than a year. Be a year in April. She bought her first house. It cost $19,900. Okay.
Yeah.
In Washington, D.C. Now, There's no such thing, due to inflation, as a $19,000 house in Washington, D.C. Doesn't exist anymore.
Not only that, but it was now you can hardly get a job that's enough to pay you. Okay,
you know what?
You'll get paid. The hours will be enough, but you won't get enough hours. I mean, the hourly rate will be enough, but you won't get enough hours. Like with my daughter, she got hired full time, and this happened to her on two different jobs. But they would send her home early, tell her not to come in, and then sometimes she only got 8 to 10 hours in a week. So
right. Well, you know,
yeah,
and you're
really...
right. So that's one of the things we want to bring up tomorrow as well. Like, for instance, a friend of mine that I went to high school with, he's with good intentions. He recommended to his son and his daughter-in-law, both in their 30s, he says, both of you need a 9-to-5 job. Now, the 9-to-5 strategy, because my friend, he's like 63 now. The 9-to-5 strategy worked for him.
Yeah.
However, the 9-to-5, and he had a job with the full benefits.
And
now
there's no such job like that now.
Exactly. So his intention was great, and he told him a strategy that worked great for him. But now, because he's retired, but like you said, today, okay, the 30-year-old, 40-year-old, even higher than that, that strategy, like you just said, no longer works. Or it doesn't
work, and then watch this. You can't take what you did 20, 30, 40 years ago and try to apply that now.
Right.
Expect someone to apply those same principles now. It's a different time, and it's a different measures. These guys now, they have no idea how brave they are living in this world.
Right.
Because it is hard to get a job. And then watch this. You go get a job, and it's still not enough to pay to provide for you. So then you got to go get a boyfriend, a roommate, or Airbnb.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. Where did I see this? I think I saw an article, and I'll try to find it. They are doing Airbnb. Oh, they're housing people, but they have to agree to. They're helping people, I think, buy houses.
Uh-huh.
Either buy houses or rent lease houses, but they have to agree to lease one of the bedrooms for Airbnb.
Okay.
To help towards their housing costs. Yes.
Right.
I will try to find that article too. Yeah.
Well, you're right. Yeah, today's strategy, we're in a gig economy. So I know another guy, matter of fact, he's one of our Facebook people.
Uh-huh.
What he does is he does Uber and Lyft.
Yep.
He does it for a 3-hour period, 5 days a week.
Yep.
He makes airport runs between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m.
Yep.
And he's able, And he's able to cover his bases from 3 to 6 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, okay. So I knew someone where I stayed at an Airbnb, right? There were two roommates. Both of them drove Lyft and Uber, and then they rented their spare bedroom, Airbnb.
Right.
So they didn't have any out-of-pocket costs for their living. Everything was provided by Uber and Airbnb.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way. So, yeah, tomorrow we're going to bring up these strategies and more because, like I say, what I classify all this is education or miseducation and then observing things in real time.
Yeah.
Okay. So because what happens is, like in the case of my friend, like I said, the 9-to-5 job with full benefits, that strategy, because he's 63 now, so
yeah.
Let's see. When he was 20, so that strategy was 33, 34, 35. That strategy worked for him since he was 23. But then how many years is that, 40 years?
Yep.
All right. However, it's a new day now.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sure there's some people out there with 9-to-5 with full benefits, but overall, those days are done.
So you got to figure what's happening
out here. In real time. Now, his son, okay, the one who's got the 4 kids and the 3 baby moms.
Right.
He's a YouTuber. But he hasn't figured out how to make money with YouTube yet.
Yeah, so he's not a YouTuber.
Oh, well, I stand corrected.
All right. If he was making money, then he could say he's a YouTuber. Okay? But if he's not, then he's like everybody else that ever since Justin Bieber got lucky and got noticed on there, everybody else thinks that they can go and get discovered or get famous or rich on YouTube. It takes a lot of work and a lot of affiliation and a lot of partnership, a lot of legwork, and a lot of diligence and discipline. These guys that are doing that stuff, they have a lot of discipline that this young fella probably doesn't have, because it sounds to me like he doesn't want to do this, he doesn't want to do that. Solutions that his father has come up with, he don't want to do. And guess what? He doesn't even have the wisdom to expect that, fool, you're in a position, beggars can't be choosers. You're not in a position that you can pick and choose, especially if you got your hand out and you coming back to mom and dad for help.
Right. Well, you bring up a good point that he's not a YouTuber, because I got a couple of friends who are YouTubers now.
Yeah,
they've got over 100,000 subscribers, but they've been at it for like 10, 15 years. But before they even got to that, they were making money, because when I met them, which is over a decade ago, they were doing YouTube videos, but they were selling product. So they were bringing in $2,000 to $3,000
a week. Now YouTube is completely different now, because even in the last 2 years, okay, they came out with YouTube Music, and it's proprietary.
Right.
So they changed a lot of their how they function out on there. Okay, so now it's not so easy for you to sell products on there anymore. As a matter of fact, a lot of practices and a lot of things that people did to make money on YouTube are against their terms of service now.
Okay.
So,
yo, you know what I discovered about YouTube yesterday when I was listening to somebody doing a live chat? No, it was on a video. Now, of course, they have super chat now on YouTube if you got like 1,000 or more subscribers. But the super chat, let's say you're in somebody that's popular on YouTube, and their super chat is, you know, people are donating $5, $10, $100, or whatever. You don't get your cut from YouTube until a month later.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
So, yeah, again. So, how come if it's my account and if it's my viewers and if people are paying into it, why do I have to wait 30 days for my money?
Right. And mind you, like I said, YouTube gets their cut first.
Oh, honey, let me tell you something about YouTube. YouTube does it like this. They go, oh, yeah, come on and make it an account. Load up all your equipment. I mean, load up all of your videos, all of your content on the site, okay? Oh, and we'll even be nice enough that when you get to 1,000 subscribers, we'll let you monetize your site. And we'll let you do this and we'll let you do that. Oh, but guess what? In the meantime, even when your account is not eligible for monetization, if one of your videos is very popular and people are getting a lot of hits on it, we at YouTube are going to start running ads.
They're making bank off your video, and we're going to keep
100% of that money.
Right.
And they're running ads off of your content without your consent or your permission. Now, if we did that, that would be illegal. So tell me why it isn't what they do it.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about your streaming stations and how people can take advantage of that opportunity so they cannot get caught into that YouTube chat.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks, Robin, for calling in. I'll probably call you later today. I'm going to enjoy the rest of this President's Day, and we're going to sign off for now because we're out of time.